The cloud cover remained unbroken as John Rourke piloted the German gunship over the Daito Islands, almost a borderline between the East China Sea and the Philippine Sea, toward the Tropic of Cancer. Paul Rubinstein sat beside him. Rourke glanced at the horizon indicator. They were in level flight, but visually it was hard to be certain. The gray of the sky and the gray of the sea blended unnervingly in an effect that made them seem one. It should have been warm here, but the outside cabin temperature at the comparatively low altitude at which they flew was below freezing. Wind-tossed white caps formed the only relief from the gray monotony surrounding them, the only possible means of sensual orientation for up and down. In the interests of not attracting Soviet attention, Rourke elected not to send out constant signals that might be picked up by midwake vessels, because they might also be picked up by the Russians. But such radio silence caution didn't preclude listening. The cacophony of natural radio emissions coming through the headsets they both wore was maddening.
Oh, I'm getting a headache listening to this stuff. To think all this is natural radio emission. Wild.
Paul had been starting fragmentary conversations ever since he woke up. John Rourke hadn't taken a nap yet. John taught Paul in the first few hours how to hold the machine on course at altitude, which was enough to allow Rourke to catch a few hours' rest. He did not look forward to rest, because it was inactivity, and there was too much to do. Paul spoke out of nervousness over the fate of his wife, Annie. John tried to keep the conversations going because he too was frightened that Annie and Natalia and Otto Hammerschmidt as well might be lost.
That explosive device we have, you sure they'll pick it up?
If we detonate it directly over Midwake, they'll pick it up. Might even send a submarine up to investigate. They better, or we're out of luck. Once we go over the Bonin Trench, I'll tack us almost due south toward the Marianas. That way we can see her set down and do any last-minute checks before we strike out for the open sea between Midway and Wake Islands. Be good to stretch our legs, too.
You're counting on the Americans at Midwake having picked up that transponder signal, aren't you?
I have to. Otherwise, Annie and Natalia and Otto are...
Yeah.
The younger man looked away to starboard.
They're dead. Shit! I mean...
And why were you and Annie and all the rest of us born into this?
Yeah. It's weather, I mean... And the Soviets trying to get the Chinese missiles... All this. I mean, isn't the world fucked up enough? It should be spring. Winter. This should be the tropics. Looks like the Arctic down here. What if we so screwed up the world that it's never gonna go back to normal?
Normal. That's a very subjective term. What was normal during the last decades of the 20th century isn't necessarily normal now. Who knows what climactic changes the Earth endured over the past 500 years.
If Paul retreated from the reality of the single option theory, that Annie and the others were dead if they had not been taken in by one of the submarines of Midwake, John Rourke knew he would, too. If Paul chattered, John found some intellectual triviality and played with it.
She's dead, John. If she's... If she is, so help me God, I'll find every one of Antonovich's troops and kill them. Hunt down the last damn one of them and choke the life out of them.
What happened to vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
What happened to justice, John?
The snow was still falling. Akira Kuranami sat before a fire he'd built to keep from freezing. He built it beneath a rocky overhang, keeping the fire as low and smokeless as possible. Periodically, Soviet helicopters still moved through the gray skies overhead. As best he could judge, if he could begin to press on within the next hour or so, he would reach Dr. Rourke's retreat sometime between dusk and dawn. Once inside, he could contact the Germans outside Eden Base. He could also turn on John Rourke's water heating system and indulge himself for as long as he wished in the warm water, borrow clothes that were dry and warm, and make a meal for himself that was warm. He rubbed his hands over his modest fire, trying to imagine what warm would be like again. Michael had been learning how to fly the J-7Vs, taking each opportunity he could at the yoke, and he flew one now. He hadn't taken it airborne, nor would he land it, although in a pinch he was confident he could do either. Had done both under the watchful eye of various of the German pilots, with the permission of Colonel Wolfgang Mann. Oddly now, Mann was one of the passengers aboard the J-7V, along with Michael's mother, Maria Leuden, Bjorn Rolvag, and a small unit of German commandos. The J-7V Michael Rourke flew was one of 18 J-7Vs, the largest group of these planes Michael had ever seen assembled, that flew a polar route toward the conflict in Lidveldet Island. Colonel Mann was following his father's advice concerning bottling up the Soviet forces in Hekla, then proceeding to throw everything available against the Soviet offensive at Eden Base. But they followed John Rourke's plan with a twist. Bjorn Rolvag, from what little Michael and Maria Lloyden had been able to understand, was obsessed with returning to Iceland because his native land was in danger. At Rolvag's feet sat his dog, Hrothgar, the animal more quiet than his master, sleeping peacefully. Michael wondered, but was unable to ask, if the dog could hold it for long enough to make the journey. From the first city, they traveled northeast over the Sea of Japan and to the Sea of Okhotsk, landing in a remote waste in northeastern Siberia to make a last-minute check before crossing the pole. Hrothgar relieved himself, then returned to stay by his master's side. Rolvag looked almost invigorated by the very sight of the barren Arctic wilderness. Maria stood outside, huddling beside him. Michael Rourke and Sarah Rourke stayed inside the fuselage, deep in conversation with Wolfgang Mann. Airborne again, they made the jump over the pole to Greenland. The twist to John Rourke's plan was a simple one. Colonel Mann, taking Michael's mother with him because she and the unborn child she carried would be safer with his force, would travel to Eden Base. But Michael and Maria, although Michael had protested, she had insisted, and he agreed she could stay with him, would join Bjorn Rolvag and a small group of German commando volunteers in an attempt to penetrate the Hekla community, rescue Madame Jokli, the Icelandic president, and generally do as much damage to the Soviet military position as possible. The J-7V cruised comfortably, easily, beneath his hands, and Michael Rourke used the time to survey what lay beneath him. Vast ice fields, as far as the eye could see in any direction. The German maps of the area showed the previous known boundary of the ice cap. Its volume had increased dramatically. Was the Earth entering a new ice age? Or was it entering the last age? If they met with success in Iceland, and Colonel Mann met with success in Georgia at Eden Base, would this 5 centuries-old war be closer to conclusion? Or would the Russians redouble their efforts to gain control of Chinese nuclear warheads and simply use them out of desperation or sheer evil stupidity? Some scientific opinion was that one more nuclear detonation would end everything forever. Michael took his eyes from the ice fields and his instruments and looked back along the interior of the fuselage. Maria Lloyden slept in one of the chairs, belted in, head cuddled against the bulkhead, a blanket drawn up to her chin. He loved her, as much as he had loved Madison, still loved Madison, but differently, not more, not less. It would have been nice to say to her, "Marry me and I'll take you away from all this. We can have children, and they'll be able to grow up in a peaceful world full of opportunity." But had anyone ever been able to truthfully say that? Had there ever been peace? And opportunity, he had always been taught, always believed, was made, not just there, waiting to be snatched. They were man and wife in every way, really. They slept together, they took care of each other. He would give his life to protect her, and she would do the same for him. Would there ever be the time to ask her to marry him? Was his father right? Sometimes he would close his eyes and see Madison, see her pregnant with their child. Would the baby have been a boy or a girl? Sometimes, too, he could see the snow-covered mound beneath which Madison and the baby lay now. Madison clothed in her wedding dress. Michael Rourke realized he was biting his lower lip, and there was a tightness in his throat. He forced himself to run an unnecessary instrument check. Jason Darkwood broke atmosphere, shaking his head to clear it. Breaking atmosphere, as the Russians call it, was never a pleasant sensation. One thing that doubtlessly the people of Midwake and their Soviet counterparts held in common was physical addiction to the scrubbed and oxygen-rich artificial environment into which they were born, in which they grew, worked, played, lived, and eventually died. As a submariner, there was really little difference. The atmosphere aboard any vessel mimicked that within the domes beneath the sea. But as a submariner, or a marine, there was always the possibility of actually breaking atmosphere, coming out of the sea, into the oxygen-depleted surface atmosphere. The shock to the body was momentarily overwhelming. Civilians, who never left the domes throughout their lives unless involved in some scientific activity, imagined the fresh air of the surface to be unimaginably sweet. Indeed, breezes cooled the skin, invigorated it, but no more so than the water would. Darkwood often wondered if it would be worth it to return to the surface, to live on the land. Beneath the sea, in the moments when thoughts of warfare could be pushed aside, it was beautiful, clean, and rich. The planet's surface was a desert, a cold and inhospitable environment in which oxygen deprivation was so normal that no one noticed it, if the Rorks were in any way typical. Portions of the surface were still so highly radioactive that they could not be entered, might never be able to be entered again.
Oh. Ugh.
And yet, at Midwake, there were growing numbers, among the young people especially, who demanded a return to the surface, insisted that they were being manipulated by the government of Midwake, that the surface had returned to some prehistoric Garden of Eden, a paradise where opportunity was limitless. Tapes of the surface were available, showing what it was truly like, but the ones who insisted on a return to the surface insisted just as militantly that the tapes were specifically shot in Arctic and desert waste areas. They claimed that the vast majority of the Earth in what had been the temperate zones before the Soviet-American conflict that began 5 centuries ago was lush, fertile farmland. Darkwood fought the feeling of nausea as calmly as he could. He looked quickly toward the shoreline. The same white sand beach, the same palm trees, very much stunted, the same splotchy snow on the rocks. Above, snow still fell. It was an odd experience. As a snowflake touched his face, he drew back from it. He laughed at himself for reacting to something so normal, at least to some people. What he could see of the lagoon and the island seemed normal, not like before. For some reason, that worried him all the more. He took a last long breath to hold him while he adjusted his helmet, then secured his helmet over his head to his suit, making the hermetic seal. A lightheadedness coming over him for an instant, predictable, as he switched to the suit's hemosponge system. He tucked beneath the surface, opening his wings and describing a cyclonic motion as he propelled himself downward toward where Sam Aldridge and the Marines were waiting on the bottom. Darkwood moved into a huddle with them. They formed a circle and touched their helmets together so they could converse. To have used radio would have been to tempt fate. The helmets reliably picked up and transmitted the sympathetic vibrations of human speech, but there was always an eerie, hollow, at times unnerving sound to the words.
What's the story, Captain?
Darkwood turned his head slightly to glance toward Sam Aldridge.
Nothing out of the ordinary is visible on the beach or in the lagoon. Taking the working hypothesis a little further, they could either be waiting for us to break atmosphere, or they might have other things on their minds entirely and not even know we're here. I'm betting on the latter. Our plan then is to get ashore as quietly as we can, ditch our wings and the rest of our underwater gear, then head inland.
Darkwood could see Aldridge's helmet nodding.
All right, you heard the captain, Marines. Any questions?
Aldridge nodded again.
Sergeant Richwood, keep 2 men with you out here until you figure we're out of the water and deployed, then come up in the middle. Kowalski, Martinez, and O'Brien, take the west end of the lagoon. Hyde, Miller, and Lucchese, you guys got the east end. The rest of you come with me and the captain. When we hit the beach, deploy first, then break atmosphere. Stick to those PV-26 shark guns our Soviet pals are so kind as to keep on giving us. The shark guns and knives, unless push really comes to shove. I don't want any noise, all right? Let's swim out.
Sergeant Richwood, a big blonde with oversized teeth that always made him look as though he was smiling, tapped 2 of the remaining Marines on the helmet, then moved off with them. The 2 penetration teams Sam Aldridge designated started toward opposite ends of the lagoon. Darkwood tapped Aldridge on the helmet, and Aldridge nodded. Darkwood let his wings fan out around him, beating them slowly, hovering for a moment. He adjusted his chest pack, and the central section of his helmet shifted from normal vision to vision intensification, casting a surreal glow over everything in the water. Aldridge signaled his men into a standard assault V, and Darkwood used wings, hands, and flippers to drop in beside Aldridge in the spot left for him, settling back to wing motion only to conserve strength as they moved ahead, the PV-26 strapped to his back. Aldridge's Marines towed buoyancy-compensated sleds. Aboard the sleds, Soviet AKM-96 rifles, a favorite for clandestine operations because the weapons were nearly as good as the American assault rifle and the ammunition could be scavenged in the field in operations against Soviet personnel. It was standard aboard Midwake vessels to carry a substantial, not equal, number of AKM-96s and the American rifles. Also aboard the floats were explosives and other gear that might be needed. Since there was no army in any conventional 5 centuries ago since, the Marines with Navy assistance were it, and had to be ready for whatever contingency arose. Darkwood often thanked God they were. He moved his wings in steady rhythm, the best way to make easy progress, working his chest pack controls periodically to make the shift from vision intensification to magnification when something curious on the bottom attracted his attention. There were fish here, not in abundance, certainly, but in significant variety. According to the latest scientific studies in ichthyology, conducted with the help of the Navy, the marine population nearer to the surface was increasing rapidly as water quality steadily improved. If the Soviets launched one of their submarine-based nuclear missiles, all of that would likely end. They soon found themselves over the shoals. At times, Darkwood helped himself along by actually touching the bottom and pushing himself ahead. The Marines towing the buoyancy-compensated sleds were having considerable difficulties moving them along. Darkwood and Aldridge fell back to assist in propelling the sleds forward. Jason Darkwood checked the luminous black face of the dual-display Steinmetz on his wrist. It cost him big bucks, as Sam Aldridge put it, but the watch was worth it. They had been swimming for better than 20 minutes. Coral outcroppings rose like stalagmites in the photographs Darkwood had seen of terrestrial caves. The shoals became more dramatic, more pronounced, and Darkwood signaled Aldridge and his Marines to lay back while he swam ahead. After another 200 yards, Darkwood broke surface, not breaking atmosphere this time, instead actuating the defogging control for his helmet. Nothing on the beach. He had not just imagined the black-clad Soviet Spetsnaz troops. Darkwood tucked under the surface, hovering for a moment, then swam back toward Aldridge and the others. He signaled them ahead. As they swam, Darkwood and Aldridge unlimbered their P-26 Shark anti-personnel guns. The bottom rose rapidly. The current grew stronger above them. Darkwood moved on knees and elbows more than swimming. At last, he rose into a low crouch. Darkwood broke the surface, Aldridge beside him. Darkwood hit his defogger. He, Aldridge, and 2 other of the Marines covered the rest of the landing party who had to hand-carry the buoyancy-compensated sleds. All of this was made the more difficult because there was no time to break atmosphere, and the environment suit now worked to suffocate the wearer. Darkwood punched off his vision intensification, realizing he was squinting with the added light on the surface. Holding his breath, Darkwood ran a few paces behind Aldridge and the other Marines as they stormed up the beach into a rocky niche 20 or 25 yards ashore. Darkwood sank to his knees, breaking atmosphere instantly. He tore off his right glove. As he tried to breathe, he reached to the hermetically sealed container pouch on his environment suit. He grabbed the butt of the U.S. government model 2418A2 with his right fist, then bit off his left glove and racked the slide, chambering the top 9mm Lancer caseless off the 15-round magazine.
So lovely here, huh? Tropical island. A little falling snow.
His breath steamed as he spoke.
And a temperature somewhere around freezing. Hey, my idea of a perfect vacation spot, right?
The other men were arming from the buoyancy comp sleds, assault rifles passed to them in a chain. They still held PV-26s because of the expected need for silence. Darkwood stripped away his environment suit, revealing his black penetration suit worn beneath. He was grateful he brought the black synthetic wool battle sweater with him. It was styled after the sweaters popularized by British commandos during World War II. It was usually too warm to wear. He felt this time would be the exception. He took the hood from the compartment on his left thigh, pulled it on over his head, only the center portion of his face exposed. The spare magazines for the 9mm Lancer caseless were still in his environment suit. He pulled them free, secured them to his chest pouches, replacing the 15-rounder with a 30, putting the nearly full 15-rounder into the pouch at his thigh, which formed the gun's holster. The handmade fighting knife he used was still sheathed to his environment suit. He resheathed it to the right calf of his penetration suit. He secured the grenade array to his left thigh, standard high explosive, smoke, and sound light. He pulled the sweater on over his head. Fortunately, it was a V-neck and large enough to allow him access to the pouches on his chest pack.
You look like Laura Lynn.
Aldridge cupped his hands in front of him as if they were supporting huge, pendulous breasts. Lara Lynn, aside from her other showbiz talents, was the hit of Midwake Entertainment for a less subtle reason, to which Aldred referred.
Thanks a bunch, Sam. Better than freezing my ass off.
I hear you.
Standard procedure for a penetration was that the suits, wings, helmets, and if buoyancy comp sleds were used, those too, were towed back to the relative safety of the water. Two of Aldridge's men were still in environmental suits, helmets off, and as some of the other Marines began carrying the sleds back down the beach, security on either side of them, these two, still in their environment suits, re-helmeted, got a thumbs-up signal from Sam Aldridge and ran after them. Darkwood, Aldridge beside him, watched as the two men brought the sleds beneath the surface, then they too disappeared beneath the surface of the lagoon. With the environment suits, of course, they could stay underwater forever until they died of old age, boredom, or starvation. The suits were even designed so that the wearer could urinate while wearing one, the urine storing in a pouch built into the leg of the suit. The starvation part was a potential problem, but the men could take turns breaking surface, then break atmosphere long enough to get down a nutrition pack. Marines were taught to do that sort of thing, so Darkwood dismissed their problems. He had enough of his own.
So, Jason, where's this training center supposed to be? They asked me to come here and never told me where it was.
Well, it should be well inland, that's all I know. The psych people figured that the best way to acclimate these guys to surface warfare was to get them as far away from the water as practical. So psychologically, they would get used to a strictly terrestrial environment. So we go inland and look for signs of the Marine Spetsnaz ahead of us.
I'm sending one of the penetration teams around to the far side of the island to look for that island classer. If they don't see one, then what?
Hell if I know.
Darkwood shifted into his pack.
We improvise. Either that, or I see an eye doctor when we get home.
He had seen what he had seen. He knew that. Darkwood took one of the AKM-96s and a bandolier of spare magazines, slinging the bandolier cross-body, right shoulder to left hip. He holstered the 2418A2, secured it, then checked the action on the AKM-96. It was typical, sloppy but reliable. He rammed the magazine home. Off in the brush, Sam Aldridge briefed one of the penetration teams for the tour around the island. Darkwood stared ahead into the dense island growth. Palm trees, traditional jungle vegetation, pine trees, snow in the pine boughs. He judged the wind and temperature combined to make a wind chill factor about 10 degrees or so below freezing. He pulled on his gloves. Aldridge was back at his side.
Ready.
Let's go.
They started out of the rocks, across the sand, into the odd-looking jungle. Men fanned out ahead of them, rifles slung, PB-26s in their hands for silent killing if needed. If this were a full-scale Soviet invasion of the island, there was nothing to do but observe and get the hell out, Darkwood realized. But how had the Russians learned of Iwo Jima's secret, and how fast could a counter-invasion force be assembled? Aside from Sam Aldridge and a comparative handful of Marines, surface warfare experience was minimal. Had the Soviets been training for surface warfare at an accelerated pace? He remembered some of Dr. Rourke's and Major Temerovna's stories. Soviet armored vehicles and helicopter gunships. He shivered, and not from the cold. The sweater and his movement were doing their work. Iwo Jima was a secret, but what if the secret it held were something no one at Midwake imagined? Sam Aldridge stopped.
I think somebody pissed here.
There was an aggregate of bright green leaves with yellow fluid puddled in them. Maybe it was plant sap. Darkwood bent closer, smelled it. He looked at Aldridge.
If you tell me many horses pass here or something, but you're right.
They weren't alone. The specially modified German gunship's course followed north of and parallel to the Tropic of Cancer. Still, there was no relief in the weather. Snow fell through higher-than-normal winds, but not so high as to seriously hinder navigation, and lower-than-normal temperatures. An hour earlier, they landed on one of the smaller islands, where snow was accumulating on the tropical foliage. They used the time to check the gunship's systems, top off the synth fuel, and take a hasty meal of German freeze-dried rations. Not as tasty as the Mountain House foods Rourke stocked at the retreat, but just as nutritious. Again, they were airborne. Rourke gave Paul the stick as they flew on over the ocean. Time dragged. Everywhere Rourke looked, everything seemed the same. If they were able to contact Midwake, and Annie, Natalia, and Otto Hammerschmidt had not been heard from. Annie, his daughter, was special to him beyond any words he could conjure, and he loved Natalia. The monotony of gray sky and gray sea suddenly broke. A black shape appeared on the horizon. Not quite as large as one of the myriad islands dotting the ocean surface below, it looked more like a smallish atoll, but something was just not right about it. It looked man-made.
Paul, take us a little north. Let's see what that is.
His movements deliberate, smooth enough, Paul banked the helicopter off its course toward the mysterious dark shape. They flew on for a few seconds. Rourke kept his eyes set on the gradually growing black form. Rourke's hands closed over the tubes of his German binoculars. He raised the binoculars and began to focus. The shape was definitely man-made because of the regularity of its... John Rourke lowered the binoculars.
Paul, that's a Soviet island-class submarine.
The aircraft jerked slightly.
Take it easy. Hold your course. We wouldn't come in range of anything short of a missile for at least another minute.
Rourke raised the binoculars again as the German gunship closed on the Soviet vessel. He let the binoculars hang from the neck strap and unrolled the chart by which they flew. The island off which the Soviet vessel lay was Iwo Jima. A group of six men in the black uniforms of Marine Spetsnaz moved in single file along a rough trail, cutting southward through the snow-splotched jungle, their AKM-96s slung to patrolling carries. The trail wound along a sprawling ridgeline, and almost a half mile away from them, through his binoculars, Darkwood could see their faces clearly. They didn't look like Americans, whatever Americans looked like. Perhaps a mile farther back along the trail over which the six men moved, gray smoke rose skyward in a ragged column. It was the smoke that first drew Darkwood, Aldridge, and the rest of their marine contingent into the island's more densely vegetated highlands. The snow was deeper here, with more snow falling, larger flakes, bafflingly beautiful and diverse to Darkwood and the others who had never seen a snowflake in anything but an old film from 5 centuries ago, before their ancestors built the scientific station of Midwake and were stranded there by events beyond their control. A scientific research station between the islands of Midway and Wake, aimed at furthering man's knowledge of space station construction and deep space travel, suddenly became the last actual outpost of the United States of America, governed by a president, a bicameral legislature, a microcosm of the macrocosm. But it never snowed there. As Jason Darkwood crouched behind a tall, wide-trunked, shallow-rooted tree he couldn't identify, he tasted another snowflake, there and gone. He looked at the tree, looked it up and down. There were many trees in Midwake, all selected for their superior abilities to produce oxygen from carbon dioxide through photosynthesis beneath miniature artificial suns. Terrestrial botany was a specialty he never studied. Few did. The broad, bright green leaves above him sagged beneath the weight of accumulated snow. Aldridge knelt beside him.
What do you think, Jason? Take him?
Sam's voice brought Jason's mind back to the situation at hand. He momentarily regretted that because he wanted to remember the taste of snow, the feel of it.
Yeah, but quietly if we can, Sam. We've got them outnumbered, but a firefight could turn that equation inside out real quick.
Here in the highlands of the island, it actually was like some paradise, like what the protesters insisted the entire surface of the Earth was within the temperate zones.
I assume you want somebody to talk.
Yeah, that'd be nice, Sam. I don't feel like having them activate those self-destruct charges they carry on their bodies and taking us with them. Rifle butts, fists, and knives if you have to. And don't forget about me.
Sam Aldridge grinned at him and nodded. With Aldridge and 4 other Marines, the rest of the force waiting 100 yards farther up the trail, Jason Darkwood slipped into the foliage overlooking the trail from the high ground, waiting. There was a conceit adopted ever since discovery of the much larger Soviet Pacific base 5 centuries ago. One American can lick any dozen of the commies. Darkwood imagined the phrase was older than 5 centuries, but surprisingly it became an operational principle. With more men at his disposal, why had Sam Aldridge only asked for 4 volunteers? Everyone volunteered. Aldridge took his pick and left the remainder of the men under his sergeant. Still more bizarre, Darkwood said nothing, simply went along as one of the 6. 6 Americans, 5 of them Marines, versus 6 Soviet Marine Special Forces personnel was taking unfair advantage, if you believed in the conceit. Three of the Marines moved up a dozen yards or so along the trail. Aldridge and Lance Corporal Lanigan stayed in position beside Darkwood, flanking him. 6 against 6, or 72 lying in ambush for 6, if you believed the principal. The palms of Darkwood's hands sweat inside his gloves as he held the AKM-96 tight. He peered between 2 snow-laden leaves. Jason read in books about the sounds of snow crunching under boots. He didn't notice the sound beneath his own boots or those of Aldridge's Marines. He noticed the sounds now. He could see the face of the lead man, not necessarily the leader because of his position in the file, but obviously the leader because of his rank. He was a sergeant. The remaining 5 men were younger, not as experienced-looking, and not as tough-looking. Sam Aldridge tapped Darkwood on the shoulder, pointed toward the sergeant, then tapped himself on the chest and nodded. Darkwood shrugged his shoulders and eyebrows. If Sam Aldridge felt he had to brace the toughest-looking one of the 6, good for him. They didn't seem to like each other, either that or they were tremendously disciplined, each man's face set in a neutral position. No idle chatter, no laughter. Darkwood looked at Sam Aldridge, figuring Aldridge would take the lead, make the first move, since his chosen target was the man to get. Aldridge flexed his fists over his rifle. Sam sprang from his crouch, hurtling himself through the foliage and down into the trail in a cloud of suddenly displaced snow, moving as if his legs were made of coiled springs, landing on his feet in the center of the trail less than a yard from the Soviet sergeant. The sergeant froze. Aldridge snapped the butt of his AKM-96 across the jaw of the Russian, and the Russian fell back.
Now!
Darkwood jumped through the foliage, not nearly as gracefully, he realized, slamming into one of the Marine Spetsnaz as the man turned toward him. Darkwood sprawled across him as they fell across the trail. The Russian behind Darkwood's man tripped, falling over them. Darkwood rolled away, hammering a right cross into his target's jaw. Lance Corporal Lanigan was locked in combat with the man who tripped over Darkwood and the Russian. As Darkwood reached for his man, he saw something he realized he'd never forget for the rest of his life, however long or short that might be. The Marine Spetsnaz sergeant hadn't fallen down. He simply stood there. Sam Aldridge seemed in freeze frame with his body poised for a forward butt stroke. The Marine Spetsnaz sergeant threw down his rifle and drew his Marine Spetsnaz issue fighting knife.
Eat shit, American! Black bastard cocksucker!
Darkwood couldn't take his eyes from Sam Aldridge and the Russian. Sam was descended from one of the first Marines at Midwake, an officer and deep diving specialist. Sam's knife was a copy of that 5-centuries-old K-Bar USMC fighting knife his ancestor brought to Midwake as a personal weapon when the colony began. It was identical to the one taken from Aldridge when he was captured by the Soviets. Aldridge threw down his rifle and drew his knife.
Your mama, bitch!
Darkwood saw his man moving at the far right edge of his peripheral vision, and he rolled away. For the first time, Darkwood realized he'd lost hold of his rifle. He was Navy, not a Marine. And the Marines, they taught you to hold onto your rifle like a lonely man might hold onto his organ on a long night. In the Navy, a rifle was something you learned to shoot, then said, "That's nice," and forgot. The Marine Spetsnaz lunged. Darkwood came to his feet. He hurled dirt in his opponent's face. As the man recoiled, Darkwood pulled his knife from its sheath. As the Marine Spetsnaz lunged, Jason Darkwood stepped back, pivoted, caught the man's knife against his. The Marine Spetsnaz fell back. Jason Darkwood's eyes focused on the Russian's eyes. The Russian's eyes flickered, and Darkwood lunged. The tip of Darkwood's blade crossed the inside right forearm of the Marine Spetsnaz. The knife fell from the Russian's suddenly limp fingers, his mouth wide open in shock. Darkwood stepped inside the Russian's suddenly vanished guard. The butt of his knife hit the base of the Russian's jaw. Darkwood's left knee smashed upward. With a chop from the buoy's primary edge, or even the blunt impact from the butt of his knife across the back of the Marine Spetsnaz's neck, the man would have died. Instead, Jason Darkwood let him fall. Mechanically, Darkwood looked around him, the other Marine Spetsnaz personnel subdued, all except for the sergeant who fought Sam Aldridge, and Darkwood's eyes riveted to them. They moved in a classic knife fighter style, each testing the other's reaction times with feigned lunges, withdrawals. The Soviet sergeant held his blade easily, as though he weren't really holding it at all, as though it were simply part of his hand. Darkwood wiped his own blade clean across the back of his enemy's uniform, sheathed it quickly as he reached for his AKM-96. Darkwood rose to his full height as he brought the AKM-96 up, holding the rifle by the barrel near the front sight. Darkwood swung. The blow caught the Soviet sergeant across the shoulder blades. As the man rolled onto his back, his face contorted into a mask of pain, Darkwood inverted the rifle. Its muzzle almost touched the tip of the man's nose.
You guessed correctly, comrade. There is no wish to make noise with a gun. In your case, there can be an exception. Try me.
The Marine Spetsnaz sergeant raised his hands. His knife fell from his fingers into the snow. Damien Rausch's right first finger touched the rear trigger of the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG. The 7.62mm sniper rifle was only one of two in the strategic supply cache he and his men discovered through the cooperation of Commander Christopher Dodd. The M16 rifles, though like the sniper rifle 5 centuries old, had decidedly greater potential for his overall purpose. But sniper rifles could be useful. Now, for example, he thought. His finger snapped off the rear trigger, then eased forward along the edge of the guard, just beside the front trigger, now set to go with the very slightest pressure. The German vision intensification scope, conveniently enough mounted to the Austrian origin rifle with only a slight machining modification to the rails on the receiver, showed Dodd's yellow nemesis clearly enough, this Akiro Kuranami. Kuranami was only a lieutenant, a very young man, yet Dodd perceived Kuranami as his arch-rival for control of the Eden Project. Once there was an appropriate lull in the battle between the Soviets and their growing list of Allied enemies, Dodd was convinced he would have to allow free elections for the leadership of Eden Base.
If Kuranami runs against me, there's a good chance he'd win. You'd be dealing with him, the man who helped Rourke and Mann overthrow your leader. But if Kuranami were out of the picture, there'd be no one else to challenge me. If elections did come, I'd be the easy victor and our arrangement could continue.
Rausch watched Kuranami move along a steeply rising road toward the face of a mountain. Was this actually the entrance to the survival retreat of the infamous Dr. John Rourke? Rausch wondered.
What does he have in there?
All things might be of value in the struggle to restore to power in New Germany those who followed the philosophy of the leader, specifically himself. If he shot Kuranami, who according to Dodd knew the secret entrance to Rourke's mountain retreat, the secret would die with Kuranami. He released the SSG's 5-round magazine. Only 4 rounds remained in the rotary feeding box. He worked the bolt, ejecting the chambered round, catching it in mid-flight. He closed the bolt and snapped off the front trigger with the chamber empty. Damien Rausch rolled onto his back in the snow.
But Herr Rausch!
Rausch only smiled as he put the loose round back in the magazine.
Watch him.
He put the magazine back in place, then gave it a firm slap. Akira Kuranami's bones ached, as did every muscle that wasn't numbed from the cold. He kept walking, Elaine's face in his thoughts. Her face and the knowledge that the retreat's main entrance was just a little farther away was all that kept him going, had kept him going as he walked on and on. The snow fell more heavily, and there was little Soviet helicopter traffic, especially since nightfall. If somehow he were attacked, he wouldn't be able to activate the controls of the pistol at his side. He kept walking, not thinking about moving his feet, not thinking about anything except the woman he loved and the warmth and food of the retreat. But first, the radio, of course, to contact the German command outside Eden Base, warn them that an unprecedented number of Soviet gunships was gathering for an all-out attack on Eden Base and their own airfield. Perhaps Colonel Mann could be contacted, divert some of the forces of New Germany in time to do something. That was the only hope. He ran the procedure through his mind for opening the entrance to the retreat, almost fearful to do so because, he realized, if he made the picture too real in his mind, perhaps his mind would withdraw to that and he would lie down in the snow and die while fantasizing he was opening the entrance door. But he would have little time to open the door when he finally reached the retreat. Little time because all of his will and momentum would be drained. The rock. He would have to move the rock. 2 rocks, like some ancient Egyptian tomb or something. The large boulder that could be pushed away easily enough by a strong man, then the squared-off rock. Pushing against that was considerably more difficult. There would be a rumbling that seemed to come from deep within the mountain itself, and the granite on which he stood would begin to lower, and as it did, a slab of rock within the side of the mountain would move away, inward. And then rest. Damien Rausch and three of his men moved along the trail on foot, keeping just far enough behind Kurenami that if the Japanese naval aviator were to turn around, they could duck out of sight.
The injection kit is ready?
Yes, Herr Rausch.
He is not to be killed.
Yes, Herr Rausch.
Damien Rausch felt a thrill he rarely experienced. As a youth, he studied archaeology with a passion, that passion only secondary to his passion for the fatherland, his devotion to the leader. The man chiefly responsible for the deposing of the leader, with the aid of the traitorous Wolfgang Mann and his officers, built this place 5 centuries ago to weather the inevitable coming storm. Inside, he, his family, and a Jew and a communist survived, slept much like the Eden Project personnel slept in their cryogenic chambers aboard the space shuttles. What mysteries did Rourke's place hold? Greater things than Rausch could obtain from the Eden Project stores, greater wisdom than he could avail himself of from the Eden Project computers. Here was not an outline of the past. Here was the past, perfectly preserved, just as it had been when it was placed here. Once Kurenami stopped and began to open the secret entrance, they would strike, and the thoughts of what lay beyond that entrance tantalized him. Paul Rubinstein sat at the controls of the German helicopter gunship. Snow fell heavily. At the south center of the island of Iwo Jima, there was smoke, a lot of it, rising skyward in a heavy column, so heavy that the column reached considerable height before fully dissipating in the strong crosswinds. They finished the circle of the island, John Rourke aware of the fact that his friend was having trouble keeping the machine under control, ready to seize control if needed, but letting Paul get the experience. They flew only close enough that Rourke could get some perception of detail through the powerful German binoculars, but hopefully not close enough to draw attention to themselves from the ground.
What the heck's going on? Why the smoke?
John Rourke couldn't resist.
Well, where there's smoke, as they say. It's a good question, Paul. If it were only that island-class Soviet submarine, I'd say they were stopping for some mundane purpose. But the smoke in the middle of the island makes it look like something else. I'll take the controls. We're going in. I'm banking on their sensing equipment all being sea-oriented. If that's the case, the higher altitude we come in at, the less chance we'll be spotted. Then we'll drop altitude over the center of the island.
You got the stick. I'll get our gear ready.
John Rourke only nodded. No time to waste, but if the island classer were in combat, their only possible opponents would be from Midwake. That meant a chance to contact Midwake sooner, more surely. He squinted toward the hulking black shape of the submarine. Rourke started the German gunship climbing. He could run with silenced rotors once they were over the island in the event the island classer put a party ashore. If the island classer hadn't, what was the origin of the smoke? He glanced aft. Paul Rubinstein was checking the M16s. Lance Corporal Lanigan, under Captain Aldridge's orders, inserted the needle. Jason Darkwood was relieved no one expected him to do it. Few things made him feel squeamish, but watching a hypodermic injection was one of them. Since the Marine Spetsnaz sergeant was the ranking man, he was the logical place to start. As with many truth drugs, it was necessary to supplement the dosage of the drug as the interrogation progressed, all of it rather subjective. Lanigan was the logical man for the detail, since he was studying pharmacology and planned to pursue a pharmacological career after his stint in the Corps. The drug used for special operations such as this, where an enemy was interrogated in the field, was identical to the most popular of the Soviet truth serums. Midwake official reasoning here quite sound, Darkwood thought. It was possible that any truth serum Midwake medical scientists might independently devise could be compromised. Then it would be a simple matter for Soviet personnel with access to sensitive information to be conditioned against the effects of such a drug. The Russians would never condition their own people against their own truth drug. Such just didn't happen in a police state. So far, the Soviets hadn't gotten wise to the fact that the Americans at Midwake were using the Soviet drug's identical duplicate. Lanigan removed the needle from the intravenous receptacle he installed, but Jason Darkwood turned around too soon, saw it, and his stomach started to go.
Oh.
Darkwood looked skyward to take his eyes away from the scene. He caught a glimpse of a dark shape against the gray clouds just passing out of sight over the trees.
Either the Russians have secretly been growing gigantic birds, or one of those helicopter things just passed over our heads.
Right. We would have heard it. Remember the ones before? We heard those. No. And anyway, only the surface-based Russian. Oh, shit.
Yeah, well, my sentiments exactly.
The Spetsnaz sergeant should be ready to talk in...
The young Marine consulted his watch.
Just about another 10 or 15 seconds, sir.
Darkwood looked back. Maybe the Marine Spetsnaz sergeant would have some interesting things to say. There was a ridge leading from the island highlands. Near to the height of the ridge, the gray smoke still rose. The search for a suitable landing area took longer than Rourke wanted, but the wind was increasing, making precise maneuvering more difficult. Visibility was dropping, and the storm intensifying. At last, an opening in the snow-splotched tree canopy presented itself, and Rourke brought the gunship in, less than a mile from the mysterious smoke, landing in a shoaled area through which a wide, shallow stream ran. Not the best landing site, but adequate. Snow stuck to the ground in many areas, and the broad, bright green-leaf tropical foliage weighed heavily down under its weight. The high winds above the forest canopy blew as occasional strong gusts on the ground.
Paul, you stick with the machine!
Rourke was beginning to slip into his coat beside the open fuselage door.
Wait a minute! Fine, you taught me how to keep the helicopter on course in a level flight. I don't know how to get one of these off the ground with any degree of safety, let alone land it. Remember the last time I took a helicopter up?
Paul did a ridiculously brave thing, taking a gunship airborne to provide cover against Soviet helicopters as they attacked the returning Eden Project shuttles. In the process, Paul nearly died. John Rourke smiled, despite the memory of almost losing his best friend. Sometimes Rourke thought his muscles still ached from getting Paul out of the burning helicopter.
You suggest, then?
Either we both go and set the remote defenses to keep tabs on the chopper, or I go by myself.
Rourke considered Paul's words for a moment.
Yes, but if we set the remote defenses and someone actually does arrive to tamper with the chopper, the wrong kind of tampering could cause the machine to explode, and we could be stranded here with no way to continue the search for Annie, Natalia, and Otto. Yeah, logic dictates you go alone.
Rourke shrugged out of his parka and helped Paul Rubenstein to start gearing up. Natalia Anastasia Temirovna moved restlessly in her drug-induced sleep. Annie Rourke Rubenstein watched her. There was nothing else to do. All the medical supplies that might be needed if there were enemy action around the Midwake submarine were checked and ready, and the Reagan was steaming toward Midwake. Annie considered that.
Steaming is probably still correct.
Presumably, the nuclear power was used to generate steam, powering the screws that propelled the vessel along beneath the waves. She felt better in the borrowed skirt and shirt. Dr. Margaret Barrow was close enough to her in body type that the fit was good, but skirts were so short here, the uniform skirt ended just below the knee. She studied her legs beneath the hem of her skirt. She guessed they were pretty. Paul told her they were. And as she moved through the submarine earlier, when Commander Sebastian, the first officer, took her for a cup of coffee to explain what was going on, she noticed some of the men of the ship's company noticing her. Her hair was considerably longer than that of any of the women aboard the Reagan, the women of the bridge crew, in regs, as Margaret Barrow put it. But even Margaret Barrow's hair, though longer than that of the other women, was comparatively short. Annie wondered if that were the style all over Midwake or just in the military. She spent a short time in Midwake, aboard a submarine just like this. After her father's return from Midwake, he announced he had been diagnosed with and cured of radiation-induced thyroid cancer. With her mother, her father, and Paul accompanying, she traveled to Midwake. She found herself mesmerized by the video projection of the sea, as though it were a window to the sea, because it looked just like that. Paul, Michael, and Natalia, too, of course, went through checkups. All received clean bills of health.
That was good news.
Her own examination had shown her in perfect health, as were her mother and the baby. As a result of the examination, it was learned that her parents' next child would be a boy. They didn't tell her father. John preferred to wait to find out until the baby was born. Annie watched Natalia. She was very beautiful, even as ill as she was. Annie had brushed out Natalia's hair, arranged it as Natalia usually did herself. The lids of Natalia's eyes fluttered, and there was a momentary glimpse of her dark, pansy-blue eyes. The pupils were dilated. Annie looked up, momentarily startled. It was Dr. Barrow.
What's the matter?
Nothing, Maggie. I just didn't hear you come in.
You're worried about your friend.
Maggie Barrow smiled, digging her hands into the side pockets of her lab coat, leaning back, then sitting on the edge of a hospital gurney, crossing her legs.
I wish I could say there was something more we could do to help Major Chemerovna. But I can't think of anything else to do here.
She's had such a sad life.
Maggie Barrow nodded sympathetically.
I understood from a brief conversation with your father that you're a sensitive.
At Midwake, after the physical examination, they asked her to indulge in what amounted to game-playing with a computer monitor. A half-dozen people she was barely introduced to trotted past her.
I'm not a mind reader, no. It's just that with people I know, I care about, and for some reason very strongly with Natalia, I can sometimes see what they see, feel what they feel, sense danger. Or sometimes I'll dream, and in the dream I'll see what's happening. I think as it's happening. There's never been any desire to check it out anymore, even if there'd been the time.
You see things happening in dreams?
Uh-huh. But only if it's something that involves very strong emotions. I can't read cards. Well, I can, but only with people I know.
What do you mean?
Annie stood up, smoothed her skirt along her thighs.
I mean, I can't sit down with somebody I don't know and have them turn cards over and then expect to read their minds and see the cards. But I could do that with someone I'm close to. Sometimes it's terrible.
Why?
Paul, my husband. I have to force myself not to read his thoughts sometimes. I mean, sometimes I'll just be sitting there and he's near me and I'm not really thinking about anything, and suddenly I know what he's thinking and I force myself not to because it's like robbing someone of their most prized possession.
And you can do this with Major Chemerovna?
It's like we can communicate without talking. And it's different with her. There was this man, part of the Eden Project. He turned out to be a traitor, and he kidnapped me. I escaped from him, and I killed him. But I learned how I should do it from going into Natalia's mind with my mind. It scared the crap out of me, but he scared me more. So I did it. I went in. I really...
How do you mean, went in?
Just what I said. I talked to Natalia about it afterwards. She said she didn't understand at the time. She just started thinking about this time she had been captured by these revolutionaries or something, and they were going to kill her, but first one of them was going to rape her. Well, I learned from her experience. When he tried this man, Blackburn, I stabbed him, just like Natalia did.
Margaret Barrow clutched at the hem of her skirt as she uncrossed her legs, her shoulders hunching.
That's disturbing.
Yeah, I know.
There was something in Maggie's eyes beyond being scared, Annie Rubenstein thought, but it was only that, a thought.
Are you afraid? I mean, afraid of what you can do?
Sometimes. I'm just afraid I'll get better at it. That scares me to death.
What's Major Chemerovna thinking right now?
Oh.
She turned around, feet and legs together, feeling suddenly very cold, and she looked at Natalia.
I don't know if I should.
Trust me, I've got an idea. But try this, okay?
Annie nodded. She closed her eyes. She thought about Natalia, picturing Natalia in her mind, picturing what Natalia could be thinking about. Annie saw her father's face. It kept appearing and disappearing, in one place, then another place, out of darkness and out of fire. He was wearing his sunglasses, the dark-lensed aviator-style glasses he wore so frequently because he was very light-sensitive. She saw his face more clearly now, and reflected in the glasses.
No! No!
Annie Rubenstein fell to her knees. The floor felt cold through her stockings. She hugged her arms tight to her chest, and she felt Maggie Barrow's hands on her shoulders, felt her kneeling beside her.
Annie!
Oh, I saw inside! Oh, inside Natalia's dreams!
Was it?
And my father's glasses! I saw!
Everything was moving around. She felt cold and hot all at the same time, and when she opened her eyes, everything looked green for an instant, and then... Paul Rubenstein dropped to a crouch along the side of the naturally formed trail on the ridgeline. A few hundred yards back, he discovered footprints and other markings in the snow and on the brush, signs that a group of men in military gear had passed this way. They seemed not very good at concealing their passage, nor the best woodsmen either. Paul backtracked their trail 100 yards or so toward the higher ground above the ridgeline. It seemed evident that whenever the group made a choice between two paths of travel, one being the clear choice of the experienced outdoorsman, more often than not, the group made the opposite choice. Paul Rubinstein recognized the pattern, remembering how comparatively short a time ago, despite his 5 centuries nap, he had been grossly inexperienced. He learned quickly because he had to, and he had the best teacher. These men, whose trail he now paralleled, would learn quickly too, or die. Signs of a scuffle in the snow. With the point of the Gerber MK2, he cleared away freshly fallen snow very gently, finding some traces of blood. Beside the trail, someone had either sat or fallen. In other places, too many footprints, only partially drifted over and obscured body prints. A fight involving a dozen men or more. After that, the footprints he followed intersected here, either joining or following the participants. These footprints, in some cases, overlaid the earlier prints. He identified 2 different patterns in the boots, clearly indicating 2 military groups.
Damn! I should have memorized the Midway boot patterns.
Paul looked to right and left, up and down the trail, and in the rocks above. Clearly, one type of the footprints came from the region where the gray smoke, still rising near the horizon, originated. Now, those footprints, along with many others, the second tread pattern, in substantially greater numbers than the first, moved toward the smoke again. Paul Rubinstein slung his M16 behind him, loosening the sling of the Schmeisser submachine gun. At close quarters, it was the better choice, and it would be close quarters crossing through the forest. It was impossible to think of it as jungle with the snow. But crossing through, rather than taking the ridgeline trail, might get him to the source of the smoke ahead of the force taking the trail. He left the trail, careful to blend his own footprints in as well as possible with the melange of footprints already there. He doubled back, leaving the trail at the first opportunity where his doing so wouldn't be immediately and obviously noticeable. If John Rourke decided to follow him, that was a different story. Where the terrain allowed, he kept a jog trot, time slipping away. John Rourke, an M16 chamber-loaded on either side of him, sat cross-legged on the cabin floor of the German gunship. He was stripping and cleaning his pistols, one at a time. Both of the Detonix miniguns were already finished, and he started the first of the 2 full-size Detonix Scoremasters. He removed the magazine, worked the slide to verify visually and tactily that there was an empty chamber, then drew the slide rearward until the slide stop and disassembly both lined up. Then he pushed out the slide stop. He took the slide forward on its rails, removed it from the frame, then set to separating recoil springs and guide rod from the barrel. Then he removed the barrel from the slide. With his German duplicated brake-free CLP, he began swabbing out the bore. A detailed stripping was not necessary. John could do this kind of work with his eyes closed, so while he was careful to do the job well, he let his mind work on other things. For instance, the island-class Soviet submarine. Why was it here? The smoke was the key. Perhaps the Soviets merely surfaced, as they might routinely do, and some sharp-eyed person on the sail noticed the smoke coming from the center of the island. Perhaps it was only a lightning strike, but John Rourke doubted that. He suspected a scenario that might fit. Either Midway or their Soviet antagonists had established some sort of base on Iwo Jima, and the 2 forces were in conflict, perhaps accidentally. If some full-scale operation were in progress, why was the Soviet submarine surfaced? And to the best he could determine, why was there only 1? There was no sign of the smaller submarines of Midway. He let those thoughts stew as he wiped off the gun parts, then began reassembly. In the days of normalcy, what few of those there had been, one of his favorite things to do in an off moment, what few there had been, was to read the latest gun magazine. One of his favorite writers, Jan Le Borel, struck him as an erudite man. Perhaps, Rourke reflected, that was because his own opinions often coincided with Le Borel's. As Rourke reloaded the Scoremaster, then began to safe and disassemble the second one of the 2 full-sized .45s, he realized how much he missed the days of normalcy. Peterson's handguns, which Le Borel edited, could never be delivered to his door by the postman. He had no door except the rock slab that masked the entrance to the retreat. And there were no more postmen. It was necessary to seek the higher ground, and not much ground was higher here except those places where only a mountain goat might move comfortably. Damien Rausch, 2 of his men flanking him, clambered along a narrow ledge, moving slowly upward. Kuranami was lost from sight here. Rausch's field glasses, fortunately still cased, slammed against the rock wall. He kept climbing. At last, the edge narrowed and leveled slightly. The sick feeling in the pit of Rausch's stomach eased slightly. The snow made the footing treacherous, and if he fell from the ledge, he would have to make his own way down, but he dismissed thoughts of the descent until the descent was upon him. There was a tongue-shaped outcropping. It would overlook where Kuranami had stopped, where somehow the entrance to Rourke's mountain survival retreat had to be. Roush moved out along the outcropping, at first in a crouch, then to his knees and elbows, crawling the last few yards through the cold wetness of the snow. Roush uncased his binoculars and adjusted the focus as he settled them on the Japanese naval aviator.
Should we?
No. Wait.
Roush lowered his field glasses for an instant. He blew the snow from the objective lenses and raised them. Kuranami had moved left. He braced his body against a flat stone and pushed it. The man looked incredibly tired, bone-weary. Roush bet with himself and won. Kuranami collapsed to his knees beside the rock. Again, the man threw his weight against it. He stood as the rock began slightly to budge. As the rock moved, the ground beneath Kuranami's feet began to sink. Roush blinked. A segment of the mountain wall behind Akiro Kuranami began to move inward. Rourke's lair. Kuranami stumbled toward the opening, disappeared through it. Roush grabbed his radio.
Close in! Close in now, quickly!
A red light filtered through the snow, washing the ground before the opening in the mountain wall. Roush's stomach knotted again as he pushed himself to his feet and ran in a low crouch, and then came to his full height, leaving the outcropping, the men who had accompanied him barely keeping up with him. Roush reached the rock ledge, took each step with care, and with all the haste caution would allow, reached the narrower portion of the ledge. The footing was impossibly slick, and the snow-slick rock wall provided little handhold for him. He moved downward along the ledge nevertheless, skidding, slipping, catching his balance, freezing in place for an instant of fear, then forcing his legs to move again. He reached the base of the ledge. Roush jumped, came down in a crouch in deep snow, and ran around the side of the rock wall. There it was, the opening, red light still flooding the snow-packed ground. The depression still in the ground where a portion of it had lowered when the Japanese pushed the squarish rock.
We have him here, Roush! We have the Japanese officer! Here, Roush!
The shout came from inside where the red light originated. Roush slipped once, caught himself, ran again, reached the opening, and stepped through.